see, we have some new friends with us this evening, starting with Isha here, who's a journalism graduate student. Hey, say hey! Mataji!
Jai Shri Krishna.
Jai Shri Krishna. You all know Sharon Dannon, our revered founder. We're just making some introductions. So Isha I met Sunday at the Krishna Temple in Brooklyn. There was a memorial service for Yamuna, the author of this marvelous cookbook, Lord Krishna's Cuisine, classic work of Indian vegetarian dishes. And Isha came, so we met there. And Paula, you're here for the first time this evening. Would you like to say hello and just tell us a word or two about yourself? How'd you get here?
Frank practices here. I usually practice at Kula downtown in Tribeca. So this is one of my first times at Jiva. Happy to be here. Thank you.
And we know that you're usually in the Krishna room.
That's right.
Right? So yeah. Welcome to the Ganesh room.
Thank you. I actually listened to you on podcast once or twice. Decided to come to the live version.
Try not to disappoint you. What's your name?
Kristen.
Kristen.
Sorry.
Kristen.
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 Yes.
Have you been to class?
I've been in December. Time. Came like three times.
Okay, great. Well, forgive me for not remembering. Welcome back.
No worries.
See you. Anna, you're here all the time. It's great to see you. How are you doing? How was your week?
Great.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
That's a good answer.
Good week.
Samantha is visiting us from London. She's apprenticing with Tamar. And we'll be doing Jiva Mukti Arti here over the next couple of months.
Yeah.
So we look forward to that. Thanks very much. What's your name?
Ricky.
Ricky.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Have you been to our little gathering before?
I have not.
Well, welcome. This is a lovely group of people. I hope you get to meet them. Just chat. Are you taking classes here? Or?
I do sometimes take classes here, and I teach at Indiana.
Oh, lovely.
Very nice.
Oh,
sorry.
Okay. In the back of the room is our
still recording because I screwed up and forgot the prasad.
I don't know. I don't see the.
I'm recording.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, we'll bring it up here.
Yeah.
So it's a little clearer for people's ears. How was your week, Mike?
Okay. I'm healing.
Yeah. Good.
A couple months.
We're all healing.
Michael
has a very important position. He's responsible for the development of a very large piece of property in downtown Brooklyn. And so there are all kinds of considerations there. Ecological, environmental, commercial.
It's a lot. And we're broke, so, you know. We can't do what we want right away, but we're slated 600 more artists lost, so that was cool.
Oh, very good, very good. Nick, your arm is healing, is it?
Yeah, it is. Pretty good. I have physical therapy. It's been like stretches that used to be excruciating are now more just feel like less excruciating. You know, but the progress is makes me optimistic.
Have you been able to take your yoga classes and just make adjustments? Or?
I haven't yet, though. I think as mentioned in the cafe on Friday, I see the surgeon again, and I'm pretty sure that at that point it will be tomorrow. Is 1 month since surgery, and he said around this time I would be able to start lifting it on its own. He said no lifting it until then. So I have a feeling on Friday they'll tell me I can lift it, and then I think I can do some modified asanas.
Terrific.
Just take a child's pose during a down dog or something like that. So my plan is, next week to start practicing.
Good for
modifications.
You. Yeah, you can. The heart begins to yearn when you can't take your yoga after.
Oh no! I tell you what. One thing I can do is I can do a one-handed drop back.
I have no idea what that is, but I'm glad you can do it.
I'm doing it so much now because it's, you know, one of the few things, you know, the few, like, challenging, like, awesome, like, that I can do, and I'm doing it a lot. Like, I ride an exercise bike, and I do the drop-backs afterwards, that's, like, my exercise.
Good man. All right. What's your name?
Anna.
Anna, that's right. We went through this, didn't we?
Huh?
That's right. We went through this last week. Anad bhavanti bhutani parjanya anasambhava. That's right. Forgive me for not having immediately recognized you as Anna too. Right. Tamar? Does everybody know Tamar?
Tamar!
And introduce yourself to the group.
I'm Olga.
Yes, you are. Yeah, I heard all about it from your squeeze. We had a nice long chat.
It was great.
Yeah, we're going to miss you. I hope you'll stay in touch. Good, thank you. Neil, what's going on in New Jersey?
Train troubles.
Train troubles. Neil has a yoga studio. What's the name of the town again?
Glen Rock,
New Jersey. Lovely, lovely, wonderful community of people there who...
Mayberry, 6 o'clock, the stores closed, the cops walk down the street, checking the door.
And do people walk around whistling and, you know, shucking corn?
Yeah, they get looked at strange.
It's always nice to have you with us. Thank you. Kim, this is my neighbor, Kim Pichayan, who is my neighbor out on Long Island. So it's always wonderful having you with us. Thank you.
I'd like to be here.
Yeah, it's fun. You have fun. You're next.
I need to share. And I just love being here every week. I just really, really enjoy it very much. It's the highlight of my week. Oh, thank you.
Cher's kind of the master of ceremonies. She always sets up our altar in such a lovely way. And between her and Kim and one or two other people, there are always vegan treats here. We have something rather unusual this week. It's vegan, organic,
chocolate-covered popcorn.
Okay. Which, we'll see what that does to you at 10 o'clock at night. You're up. And the bench may be Sanskrit for all we know. Thank you. Emily is our litmus test. She has the most penetrating questions and the most carefully crafted observations, so that if I get a nod from Emily, I know the class has gone well. Xanthi, you want to say hello?
Hi, everyone. I'm Xanthi, and I concur with everything.
Always nice to have you here. Our beloved managing director is here this evening. This is a real treat to have.
I heard that
the trifecta.
Location at the comp.
Well, this is Ganesh Das, a.k.a. Carlos Menjivar, for those of you who may not know him. Carlos is the cerebral cortex of Jiva Mukti. Essentially, all of the electronic and electrical impulses go through him and come out in inspired ways. So the programs, the calendars. So we owe you a big debt of gratitude for allowing us to have this time here every week. Thank you so much. How you doing?
I'm fine. I'm healing all the love of it.
Oh, you're just in time, Julie. You get to introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Julia.
I'm Oh, I'm sorry.
What?
Please. Say hello.
I can introduce April. I got to know her very closely last week.
Oh,
and she is definitely a class. Dover de Divar.
Adasi.
Adasi Dover de Divar. And she's a hard worker, I was going to say selfless. And if you humble to the max, and if you guys don't know her, you should get to know her.
So those of you who are just visiting for the first time, I think you get to the idea. This is basically a love fest with, you know, a lot of ego stroking. And, you know, people generally kind of leave here with a big beam on their face because everyone's been complimenting them for who knows what. And so it's really nice. You're welcome to come. And Sharon, you want to say hello?
Hello, everyone. Hello, Joshua.
Hello, dear Sharon.
So happy to be here.
Thank you. Thank you
Whenever
for being
I'm
with us.
Whenever I'm in New York, this is a big treat for me to come and join you and to just be in the midst of how you weave the magic with Sri Krishna's grace. It's wonderful. Thank you for enhancing our school with your knowledge, your ability to create such a fun way to approach a very hefty book, and most of all, though, for your devotion to God. Thank you so much.
Golly gee willikers. Thank you. That's very nice of you. Yeah, you're really good. Apparently, we're up to something like 350 cyber friends as well now. Is that about right? Yeah, here they're in here. Is it?
200 fellows and 350 Facebook members.
Wow. Okay. Well, it's quite an age we live in, where, you know, all these people claiming to be your friend. You know, who knows who they are. I was asked to.
Enemies.
That's true. You know, Facebook enemies is a whole other category. The theme of the focus of the month is kirtan. And Tamar, who is often the inspiration for what we do here, first had me talking about Chaitanya. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appeared in Bengal in 1486 and is credited with being the father of the kirtan movement. And so we've had three classes on Chaitanya, and there'll be more later in the month. But this evening we're discussing the final verse of chapter 3. It's taken us 5 years to get to the end of chapter 3, but we're finally here. And before we begin, Tamar suggested that we try chanting two different melodies of the Maha Mantra, the Krishna Mantra. Like ragas, mantras also have different melodies, and the different melodies have each its own particular emotion or mood. And there are morning melodies, and there are evening melodies, and there are afternoon melodies, and there are melodies for particular times of the year and for particular occasions. And each evokes a certain kind of bhava, or a feeling of joy, eventually ecstasy. Bhava being the preliminary stage to prema. Beyond ecstasy, there's something beyond ecstasy, and that's love. These different melodies evoke different dimensions of these transcendental emotions. So we'll start with a morning melody. This is in a major mode. And it's simple enough, and you kind of get the idea that you can start your day with, you know, a kind of a perky kind of melody. So that's what this is. It's a perky. And it sounds like this, and we'll do this responsibly, so I'll chant once and then we can all chant together. It goes down to one low note, so I'll do my best. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, 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 Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama. you'd like to try that with me, we'll go a little slow so that we can just kind of become acclimated to the melody itself. I'll chant once more so you can get that melody. Symbols, but we're doing it without that rhythm, just to kind of follow in the mood. And it's one of the things that I've learned from you all, and I do learn so much from you, that sometimes the more contemplative way of chanting in these kirtans is conducive to allowing yourself to go inside and feel that connection with Krishna through his name. On that spiritual platform, there's no difference between the name and the person whom the name represents. They're of the same spiritual quality. So, thank you for having introduced me to a different way of chanting the Maha Mantra through just allowing the name to work its magic. So let's try that again together. I'll chant once and then we'll chant together. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. In honor of Yamuna. When I first went to a Krishna temple on December 26th, 1969, I remember it well. I walked in the door and Yamuna was the person. There's this book. For those of you who may, I shouldn't presume that you know. There's this book. It's called Lord Krishna's Cuisine. It's 864 pages long, thick like this, like a big brick. 500 recipes of pure Indian vegetarian cooking from the 12 principal culinary regions of India, put together by an old and dear friend who passed away 2 weeks ago. Her name was Yamuna Devi. And if you Google this book, you'll see that it won the, what is the equivalent of the Pulitzer Prize of cookbooks. It's called the IACP Award, International Association of Cooking Professionals. And it is a classic in its field. Yamuna, when I first met her on December 26, 1969, she was inside the door of this lovely little building that George Harrison had rented for Krishna devotees in London. Because we didn't have a temple. We had nothing. So he got us a space. And she looked at me as though I were some long-lost friend, and said, "You're just on time." I said, "Really? What for?" And she said, "Lunch." So we went downstairs, and there was a group of devotees there having this wonderful vegetarian prasadam lunch. And that was, I was hooked, you know, just first with the food, that was the first thing. And then Yamuna herself, you know, she was just this extraordinary person whom I will always remember as living larger than life. She was, first of all, a big, husky woman, but she carried herself like a ballerina. She didn't walk, she floated across the room. I've never seen anyone carry herself with such grace, such elegance. Every gesture was intentional. Every step was light and meaningful. It was fascinating, mesmerizing just to watch her. And her voice was bigger than life. Her devotion was bigger than life. And we would sit down in the temple room every day for hours, and we'd be chanting, and she'd be, her head would be going back and forth like this, and her eyes were closed, and she'd be just communing with Krishna through that chanting. So this is a melody, this is an evening melody that I learned from Yamuna. And by the way, if you're familiar with George Harrison's album, The Radha Krishna Temple, it's Yamuna singing, Govindam Adi Purusham Tamaham Bajami. So she's known from that recording.
With the nail on that.
Don't go there. And from her wonderful award-winning cookbook, and from melodies like this one.
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna.
hours and hours and hours chanting. And then more you chant the mantra. The repetition of the mantra is not something dry or mechanical. Donovan came to see my teacher, Prabhupada, once, back in those days. And he came in with his bass guitarist, bass player, and their girlfriends. And Donovan's girlfriend had on a skirt that was so short, I mean, it made mini skirts look long. I mean, it was really short. So when she sat down in front of Srila Prabhupada, one of us took a chatter, you know, claw, put it over her leg. And so Donovan was looking at Prabhupada just like this. He was looking at him. And Prabhupada was looking at Donovan just like this. And then Donovan had come because he was George Harrison's friend. And Prabhupada always knew, my teacher was an expert icebreaker. So when he would meet someone for the first time, he would think and then he'd find the right way to warm up the conversation. So he thought for a moment then and said, ah. And then he quoted a verse from the Rig Veda, which speaks about music. And he said, this verse from the ancient Vedic texts describes that music is the highest form of education. So why not do like your friend George? I'll give you the subject matter and you can write songs. Boom, they were off and running. I mean, Donovan was all over that. He just loved the idea of taking his musical abilities and putting them to some higher purpose. It was a lovely way to start the conversation. And they were starting to talk about the chanting of the mantra. And at one point, Donovan said, isn't it boring? You're chanting the same mantra over and over and over again. Why do you do that? Why don't you vary it more? So I made a mistake. I made a big mistake. In the presence of my spiritual master, you know, all of, you know, in me, my infinite wisdom at age 19, I jumped in. And I said, oh, Donovan, you shouldn't think that chanting Hare Krishna is dry. It's actually very pleasing to the heart. So Prabhupada looked at me. He kind of like... He said, that's very nice, but we're having a discussion. First, let him understand that there is a method to chanting. Then you can describe what that method is. But we haven't come to that point in our conversation yet. And then he said, just like, you know, he said to Donovan, he said, just like you know how to play guitar. He said, you know the method for how to play guitar. I don't know the method. If I tried to play guitar, even dogs wouldn't come to hear me. So he said, now you can describe. So there was a strategy behind that. Anyway, the point is that the repetition of the mantra is something that builds. Rather than becoming humdrum or dry or repetitive, it grows and it nurtures that seed of devotion in the heart and becomes something where you reach a point where you can't stop chanting. Just my teacher had his hand, I didn't bring my bead back, his hand was on his beads all the time. Even in the middle of conversations, he'd be chanting. In the middle of a sentence, he'd chant, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, and then go on. He's just like always chanting. So, all kinds of melodies. You're welcome to take these melodies with you wherever you go. If you have your Bhagavad Gita, the last verse of chapter 3 is on page 182. And before we get there, would someone like to help me pass these out? Isha, would you mind? This was an op-ed piece in the New York Times from about a week ago. That I thought, boy, we really need to be reminded of this. Pico Iyer is a very accomplished author. You'll often see his articles in the New York Review of Books, for example. And he writes a piece about how it's a healthy thing every now and then to turn off all your electronics and just come back to silence. And I thought, what a lovely thing to be reminded of in the new year. And Tamar, weren't you telling me that part of the training session What would you tell us about that?
Yeah, that there's a program called Note and Craft Week that I run sometimes, and it's a one-week experiment where you try to lower your environmental impact. And the last day of the week, after you've done all these things to lower, you know, your use of energy and water and so on, the last day of the week is to simply turn everything off and rest, not cook, not use any electronics, and so you're giving yourself a rest and you're giving the environment a rest. But for some reason, people have the hardest time actually doing that day.
Mm.
And I was comparing it to Shavasana, an asana class, where sometimes people have a really hard time taking Shavasana. They're more comfortable with doing than not doing.
Yeah. We're afraid of silence, aren't we? It's very intimidating. When was the last time you saw a moment of silence on television? Every second, every inch has to be filled, as though giving people a moment to think about what's going on is somehow going to bring down the establishment or something. This is not a culture that rewards introspection, contemplation, quiet. So anyway, I thought you might enjoy this article from the New York Times. Okay, so the protocol for chanting the verses from the Bhagavad Gita, we start with invocation, and then we'll repeat the lines together. So if you would please repeat after me. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Now you repeat.
Om Namo Bhagavate
Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Bhagavad Gita, chapter 3, verse 43. Evam Buddhe Param Buddhva. You want to try that?
Evam Buddhe Param Buddhva.
Samstabhyatmanam Atmana.
Samstabhyatmanam Atmana.
Jahi Shatram Mahabaho.
Jahi Shatram Mahabaho.
Kama rupam durasadam.
Kama rupam durasadam.
If you don't have the Bhagavad Gita, just listen and then repeat each line.
Evam
buddhe
param buddhva. Evam buddhe param buddhva.
Sangstabhyatmanam atmana.
Sangstabhyatmanam atmana.
Jahi Shatram Mahabaho.
Jahi Shatram Mahabaho.
Kama Rupam Durasadam.
Kama Rupam Durasadam.
Someone like to try? This is my favorite part of the class. I want to ask if someone would like to try repeating the verse. And nobody speaks. Go ahead, Nick. You're always game.
Yeah.
Go for it.
Well, I have to learn.
That's all right.
Evam buddhe param buddhva.
Evam buddhe param buddhva.
Samstabhyatmanam atmana.
Samstabhyatmanam atmana. Jahi Shatram Mahabaho.
Kama Rupam Durasadam.
Kama Rupam Durasadam.
Well done. Extra points. Nice. Someone else want to give it a try? What do you think, Cher?
Okay.
Go ahead.
Evam Buddhe Param Buddhva.
Evam Buddhe Param Buddhva.
Samstabhyatmanam Atmana.
Samstabhyatmanam Atmana.
Jahi Shatram Mahabaho.
Yagi Shatram Mahabaho Kamarupam Durasadam.
Okay, well done. All right, are we stopped there? Okay. Evam, thus, these are the synonyms for these words. Evam, thus, buddhe, to intelligence. Param, superior. That's a word we'll find often, or a prefix that we'll often come across in Sanskrit verses. Buddhva, knowing. Samstabhya, by steadying. Atmanam, the mind. The Atma is a very versatile word. Atma can refer to the mind, the senses, the soul, the body, humanity, the cosmos, the supreme being. The word Atma has many, many different translations, so depending on context. Right? Atmana, by deliberate intelligence. Jahi, conquer. Shatrum, the enemy. Mahabaho, almighty armed one. Krishna calls Arjuna by many different names throughout the Gita, and also depending on context, often it's as a way of encouraging him. He's saying, dear mighty arm, meaning you can do this, you can do this battle. You are Mahabaho. Pick up your weapons now. You can do this. Mahabaho. Kama rupam, in the form of lust. Well, that word kama has also many different connotations. Lust is a somewhat archaic or one-dimensional translation for the word kama. Kama can refer to any kind of aspiration for achievement in this world. Anything that furthers or perpetuates material life, conditioned life, can be kama. Kama can also be a stepping stone to transcendence. So we'll talk about that in a minute. Kama rupa. Rupa means form. So the form of kama. And durasadam, formidable. Dura means, can also mean very difficult, something that's very, very hard. Translation, thus knowing oneself to be transcendental to the material senses, mind and intelligence, O mighty armed Arjuna, one should steady the mind by deliberate spiritual intelligence. What Prabhupada defines here as Krishna consciousness, and thus by spiritual strength, conquer this insatiable enemy known as lust, kama. I would encourage you to read the purport on your own, but allow me, if I may, to offer some comments here. First of all, within context, if you want to know what a chapter is about, just go to the last verse. Usually the last verse of the chapter in Bhagavad Gita will give you a kind of a kernel essence of what's been discussed in that chapter. So there's a tip-off here in this verse as well, since it's the last verse of the chapter. The context being that Arjuna, bewildered by this utterly horrible deed that he must do, and he will be to fight this battle, and against family and friends and people he knows, has understood something, and that is that his wanting to go away from battle was a mistake. And so now he's questioning his own behavior. Earlier in the chapter, he says to Krishna, why is it that so many times we behave contrary to our own interests? I wanted to go away here. I wanted to leave my duty here, my field of battle, my arena for my own spiritual enlightenment. I wanted to go away from that. What is it that compels us to do that? To basically move away from the very thing that we should do? And Krishna's answer to him is that it is kama. Now, kama, again, when I was a lad, I understood kama to mean sex and food, basically. Got to control your tongue, got to control your genitals. That's basically it. That's kama. After a while, it became clear to me that anything that grounds us in the concept of ourselves as being a product of this world is kama. Anything that reinforces that sense of this is my real home, this is where I belong, this is what I'm a part of, and Let me make hay while the sun shines. Let me gather as much as I can. Let me go for it. That sense of ego that drives us to great accomplishment for our own purpose. Notice that qualifier there. There is nothing wrong with ego. There is nothing wrong with the drive to accomplish. But if it is all for your own aggrandizement, that's karma, and that perpetuates the cycle of repeated birth and death. So what Krishna is doing here, this is not churchianic dogma. You know, keep it in your pocket, young man. That's not what Krishna is saying here. What he's saying is out of compassion for Arjuna. He's saying, I'm concerned about you. I love you. I don't want you to have to come back here. I don't want you to get yourself into a situation that's going to be even more painful for you than what you're experiencing now. So try to understand what your real self-interest is. You know? And there may be something greater than just the immediate, obvious benefits that can be gained by running away. You know, maybe there's something higher that you can get by staying here. Since this is the last verse of the chapter, and what Krishna is pointing to is a key to unraveling the mystery of the universe, some thoughts came to mind. So I make notes. I'll do this. I'll sit down. I'll think about the verse. I'll come back and I'll say, okay, what can I say succinctly? That's something else I want to thank you all for teaching me, is to not over-prepare. I used to come into class way too prepared.
Video. Full band.
8x10 glossy photos.
Caffeine.
You remember that, huh? Those were the days.
Sure do.
And it left, first of all, you can't say everything in one gathering. It's impossible. So becoming a little bit more modest, I thank you for having reminded me to, you know, cool it. And also to leave room for spontaneity, for discussion, is critical. I mean, that's where so much can come out, is when you guys get involved here. This isn't all about, you know, yogeshwara up here, you know, yakking away. This is about stimulating discussion, okay? So here are just a couple of notes that came up for me. It's wonderful when things become clarified. You get this real sense of relief. How many of you have ever cleaned out your clothes closet or a basement? Don't you have this sense of, you know, clarity about things? You know, when you throw all that junk away and, yeah, you know, it's getting clean again. It's getting sane. There's some order to come out of this chaos. I remember one of my godbrothers on a morning walk with our teacher, Prabhupada, and asking him, why is it, Prabhupada, that before I became a Krishna devotee, I had my act together. You know, my life was good. You know, I had my systems down. I had my money. I had my thing. As soon as I started getting into devotional practice, my life's been a wreck. I mean, everything is just topsy-turvy. And Prabhupada said, it's like cleaning your house. When you first start cleaning your house, the furniture is out of place. The dust is flying everywhere. It looks worse than you started. But you know that by this process, things will reach a point where they will be cleaner than they have ever been before. Welcome to yoga. You start your yoga life, and at first it's like, what the hell is this? Everything's in question. All of a sudden, everything's in question. Continue with that practice, and eventually what happens is from the chaos, an order and a symmetry and a sense arises that you would never have been able to anticipate otherwise. Marvelous, marvelous thing. I had a plant that was dying in my... I live on Long Island. I had a plant that was dying. Why is this plant dying? I put it in the sun. I'm watering it. And then I felt the soil and it was too wet. And I realized that there was the hole in the pot that was supposed to allow air to circulate and evaporate the excess water, had gotten clogged. Wow! Cleaned that out, and the plant flourished again. You know, you feel good when a problem gets solved, when something all of a sudden is clarified. Or I'm writing a script right now for a documentary on a very complex subject. It's very briefly, it's about the transmission of memory of the Holocaust into the future. Once the survivors, the eyewitnesses to the horror, are all but gone now, who will tell that story? How will it be told? Through what agency? And how will it be received? How will people 10 years, 20 years, 30 years from now, when there are no survivors left, understand this very problematic period in human history? It's taken us, my partner and I, 2 years, 2 years of interviews and research and study and talk and discussion to reach a point where the script is beginning to make sense. And it's really exciting when that happens, when you begin to see a structure to something complex that you can actually describe it. It's this marvelous, marvelous feeling. So sometimes it takes a long time. To make sense out of your life can take an entire lifetime. Or it can take one session like tonight. Something can emerge by hearing something in a new way, and you're just ready for it. Maybe something you've even heard before, but all of a sudden it gets through to you. And that one statement, this one, I think I've mentioned to you this friend of mine out on Long Island who had this tragic accident, and he went into the hospital with a... he had a seizure from a poor chiropractic. You know, he was in a coma for a while. And he started taking yoga, which he had never taken before. He was going through all of the heavy medications and the allopathic medicines and everything. It was getting him nowhere. Someone said, "Have you tried yoga?" So he went to a local yoga studio. It's called Yoga Flow in Gledhand out by me on Long Island. Lovely, wonderful studio. And the teacher there said something to him that was an epiphany. Like the light went on. What she said to him was, "You are not your pain. You are not your pain." He had just never heard that, and it's just made all the difference in the world for him. It set him off on a whole other direction. He calls me and says, "Hey, Joshua, I got to sit and talk with you about yoga. Come on, let's go out. I got to talk to you. So sometimes it can be just a sentence that you hear, or it can take a lifetime. Clarifying also means discovering what something is not. I think specifically of Krishna, because we're reading Krishna's teachings. And it's always a real challenge for me to figure out how to position Krishna in our discussions. And I think we've done a fairly good job over these many years of describing what Krishna is not. What Krishna is not is the god of organized religion. Krishna is not a top-down manager who sits in judgment on people's lives. When we speak of divinity, we're speaking of something so much more nuanced, so much more beautifully complex, so much more exciting. The heart's true yearning for love, that fulfillment, that place of fulfillment of the heart's desire for love is Krishna. That personality of the divinity that allows for the exchange of love. We've talked then about how the Gita deepens our vision of the world we know. You know, the mystic experience, when you go to the classic texts like Evelyn Underhill's book simply called Mysticism from 1902, more than 100 years old, yet it is still studied as a classic work of mysticism. The mystics don't have some vision of something that is outside the scope of the reality we know. The description that most of them give, those who have come back from that experience and gifted us with an explanation of what they went through, is a deeper awareness of the world we already know. Mysticism is a state of heightened awareness of the world you already inhabit. It's not like you get in a rocket ship and go to some other planet. The mystical experience is here, now, by gaining a deeper insight. What was that thing we were talking about in the car driving? An artist. An artist will paint a painting. Now, I'm not an artist, so I can... Tamar's an artist. She can talk about this. When you're trained to look, when you look in terms of relationships, spatial relationships, size relationships, proportions, colors, dimensions, blank spaces, there are so many things that an artist will see that untrained eyes don't see. The same thing viewed by someone with that training is so much richer, so much fuller. It's such an extraordinary experience. Sharon is a master dancer. She sees movement in a way that we may not be able to see. My dad was a voice teacher. He heard Pavarotti. I've told this story. I walked in to visit him one day. He was watching live from Lincoln Center, it was Pavarotti, the first telecast opera. And he was sitting there crying. These tears were streaming down his cheeks. Like, what's the matter? And he pointed to the screen. He said, the control, the control. Now, as a voice teacher, he heard something. I couldn't hear it. And yet for him, it was this transcendent moment of hearing Pavarotti sing.
Joshua?
Yeah.
Tata Yoga Nushashanam. That is what Patanjali says. Mm-hmm. It is the first sutra, Patanjali Yoga Sutra. Just what you're talking about.
How would that translate, Sharon, that verse?
Now this is yoga as I have observed it in the natural world.
Ah.
Anushashanam. Anu means atom, or small component, or microcosm, as opposed to the larger. So, shash, instruct,
mm-hmm.
now, atta,
mm-hmm.
so right here and now,
mm-hmm.
This is all, it's there for you. In life itself, you will come to know the absolute, if you look deeply.
Yes, yes, it's there.
So this is Patanjali's,
yeah.
This is the number one, the first sutra in chapter one of the Yoga Sutra.
Beautiful, beautiful. That word Anu, Adam, also appears in the Brahma Samhita, the prayers of Brahma, where Brahma prays, Andantarastam paramanu chayantarastam govinda maripurusham tamaham bhajami. That Govinda is inside the Adam and he is between the atoms, God in the details.
Mm-hmm.
The details of the life we have, the world we have, is where transcendence can be found. Heaven on earth, if you will. It's there. It's there all around us. And we're cultivating the eyes to see it through our yoga.
But we must venture deeply or live a superficial life.
Yeah. It takes some courage to do that.
Sense of adventure. Too.
Yes. It's
like
the
you
adventure.
Were talking about, you said.
Well, Krishna describes himself as adventure in the 10th chapters. I am adventure. I'm the adventure of life. Taking that risk, an exciting, wonderful thing. So this last verse of the third, here's where, all right, let's bring it all home. Let's bring it all back. This last verse of the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, what is Krishna's advice to Arjuna? He's saying essentially, live your life. Live it. Live it now. Live it. Informed by what you know, by your spiritual knowledge. See things with those spiritual eyes. Hear things with your spiritual ears. Experience life through your spiritual senses. You know, come alive, come up to that life which is yours by inheritance. You are by nature a divine being. Now enact that. What else is there to do? How many movies are you going to go see? There's so much excitement in this call. The Bhagavad Gita means the call of the divine. You know, it's literally a call. Here is Krishna calling to us. Come with me. Let's be together. Let's go out and meet this adventure head on, arm in arm. It's a wonderful thing. That's it. I'm done. Now it's your turn.
But is it that people mistake what it is to have a good time, a real good time.
Right. Mm-hmm. We're going to have a real good time. Yeah.
And we're just in the habit of thinking that we're having a good time when we're becoming more mired in the finite and mortal existence.
Is this ringing any bells for anybody?
Isn't that the difference between pleasure and happiness? Instead of most of us pursue pleasure, instead of pursuing happiness?
Yeah.
Can you repeat that? Because I couldn't hear you.
Yes. Michael is reiterating something we've talked about several times. That is the distinction between pleasure and happiness. The distinction between what is easily perceived by the senses and what takes effort because it is perceived by the soul, by the transcendental senses, and it is of a higher order. Nothing good comes cheap. If it's too easily attained, you have reason to question its value. If it's too easily achieved, you have reason to question its value. Krishna was dancing with the gopis. And at one moment, the gopis' ego started creeping in. And they started thinking, yeah, Krishna is dancing with me. At that moment, he disappeared and left them heartbroken. And they went literally mad. I mean, they were searching for him everywhere on the bank of the river Yamuna. They were asking the bumblebees, where did he go? Have you seen him? Where did he go? They were going mad, literally mad. Finally, they followed his footprints down to the bank of the Yamuna River. And they sat down, and one gopi started to massage his feet, another his legs, another was fanning him. You know, they were kind of looking at each other like, you know, we got to teach this guy a lesson. Why did he do that? So one gopi very politically said, Krishna, I have a question for you. Some people give their heart fully, and their beloved reciprocates that love immediately. Then there are other people. Someone gives their love, and they just ignore them. What do you think of such a person? And Krishna smiled and said, I get it. I know what you're doing. I know what you're asking and why. I left. And you want to know why I did that? Well, I'll tell you why I did that. What we have going, I'm paraphrasing here. He didn't say what we have going, but I'm paraphrasing. What we have, this love that we have.
Well, he spoke in Brajbasi, so probably it did sound pretty
it,
much
maybe
like
something
that.
Like that. Yeah, it wasn't high Sanskrit. Yeah. It was simple language. What we have is so special. It's so wonderful. It's so unique and so rare. I don't want it to seem cheap. I don't want to make myself so easily available that all you have to do is snap your finger and I'm there. You have me. You have my heart. I love you. And you love me and we will always be together. But when it becomes something that prompts the kind of ego that we were seeing there, that's when we have to be careful. What you're doing in your yoga practice is nuanced. It's a delicate creeper of devotion that needs to be nurtured and cared for every day. Don't take it for granted. You know, don't just casually fling it around. You know, this is something that by its nature, by its original intent and purpose, yoga is meant to permeate every fiber of our being. Everything that we do has a connection with our spiritual life, and in particular our devotional life. And if you give it that degree of seriousness, this was, oh my gosh, this was a class that Prabhupada, hard to remember this. He knew that we, his students, his disciples, were not always, you know, the strictest following the path and so on. And he, it was a verse and it lent itself to this. He said, look, if you're thinking, I'm going to do this and I'm also going to do that, do that. Don't do this. That's very strong. If you're thinking, I'm going to do this, well, I'm also going to do that, do that. Don't do this. Meaning, if you can't give yourself to this 100%, and if you really can't make this into the core of life that it has always been in the yoga tradition, think about what it is that you're cutting yourself off from. And again, that's what this verse is. See how wonderful it is to go down underneath the words themselves. Here's Arjuna feeling despondent. And here's Krishna saying, come on board. This is exciting. This is great. Let's go do this. Let's do this together.
You know, when you're on your spiritual journey, you know, I imagine, you know, what I feel like it's sort of hard to go, you know, cold turkey, devote yourself entirely on your journey and give up all of that. What I'm saying is, when you say, I want to do this, but I'm still going to do that, you say, don't do this, go do that. But maybe it's a phasing out process. You still have to have a little bit of that. Let it phase out a little more and more as you're exploring this.
I'll go even further than that with you. Yes, spiritual life is realized in a gradual process of step-by-step advancement. That is true. And nowhere in the Bhagavad Gita is it recommended that you artificially give up your life and just jump into some persona that you think this is what a yogi is like. That's discouraged. Krishna tells Arjuna, if you're still, you know, if you still have some material habits and, you know, there are some desires
sex,
still
drugs,
in
rock and roll.
Sex, drugs, and rock and roll still attracts you, don't pretend to be a sannyasi and go to the woods. That's hypocrisy. That's hypocritical, and you'll never be able to sustain it. You're deluding yourself. And you can do yourself harm. So be very realistic about where you are. But let me take this even a step further. If our yoga and study of Bhagavad Gita is meant to reveal to us the hidden dimensions of creation and the hidden dimensions of our life, what that suggests is that contradictions can live side by side. You can be an atheist and still be inspired by the Bhagavad Gita, for example. You can describe the ecstasies of the saints as firings in the brain and lesions and biochemical processes, and also accept that there was reality to some transcendent experience that they had, which was the trigger, the causes of all of those biochemical changes. What the Gita allows us to do is to reconcile what otherwise would seem impossible and irreconcilable. You can completely walk away and have an utter disdain for religion and God and so on, and yet be utterly fascinated by Krishna and develop a real love and affection and attachment for Krishna. Okay? So, yes, what you're saying is true. Let's make sure that we're realistic about how we make our progress. but you are not cut off from that experience of immersing yourself in chanting while you may still have those attachments. The chanting is real. And because we're entering into an understanding of our lives as being multidimensional, you can do both. So in other words, even though you're not a pure, elevated yogi yet, you are still being invited to have access to those deep, profound feelings that are known by the very advanced yogis. The difference is they can sustain it, you can't. But you're not cut off from it. I can speak from experience. I'm not a very advanced yogi. I'm not free of attachments. And yet I have known moments that convince me beyond a shadow of a doubt that what we see is the tip of the iceberg. It's just the tip of the iceberg. There is so much going on. And Krishna is real. Krishna is real. Swear to God.
No, that's nice because, yes, that's, for me, one of the daunting factors about, you know, coming into a spiritual life is, you know, to be honest, it's the sacrifices you have to make, the sorts of things that are scary to, you know, think about things that bring you pleasure instead of happiness. There's a chemical reaction you're bringing when you have pleasure, and to make those sacrifices, speaking as a human, it's hard for me, it's a little daunting. I know in my mind that there's going to be a benefit to foregoing pleasure in search of something greater. I know this, but in practice, you know, it can be hard to actually put in place.
Maybe you only do it when you're ready.
When tomorrow?
Maybe you only do that when you're ready. Meaning, you don't do that as some kind of, you don't view it as some kind of penance or some kind of difficult, horrible thing, but you do it when you're ready and you want to let go of those things.
Yeah.
But it actually maybe makes you
happy to let go of those things. That's how I. Yeah, you know. It's a very good point. Everything can be achieved with practice. Maintain practice. Every day, maintain practice. And there's no harm experimenting. If you want to fast reasonably, you know, don't starve yourself to death, right? Or if you want to go on retreat, I mean, there's a reason why retreats are important. So that you can have that full immersion experience, and then you come back, you get that inspiration, and you come back to the rest of your life. And so you gradually, it just is called in the Gita, param drishtva. It's acquiring and cultivating a higher taste. It's done gradually.
Yeah. It's not that we have no, the desire is not there, or that there's no pleasure. You kind of get pleasure just from hearing Krishna.
Reading a book, you get a different sense of pleasure. It's
something
that you can touch or feel physically, but you get a different sense of pleasure from it. So it's not like you're going to a place where there's no pleasure.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, earlier tonight, when you were talking about this stimulus, and we live in this constant, most of us, electronic stimulus, and you had said that, you know, the television is never silent. There's always some image, some sound, something. There's no chance for a moment of silence. And this morning I was listening to an old lecture it was an interview with Alan Watts, and the interviewer, who was an old friend of mine, asked him, "So are you against organized religion?" And he said, "I'm not against it, it's just that they talk too much." He said, "You go into the synagogue, the church, whatever, they're just talking. They're lecturing to God, they're lecturing to us about things that, you know, we really don't want to hear about for that long. a little bit is okay, but, you know, an hour and a half of just talking, 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 they never give you a chance to actually have an experience of what they're talking about. And that's my problem. And in the, he was saying, in the Eastern religions, contemplation is more emphasized, where you shut up and you listen. And he said, chanting is that. It's a practice of shutting up and listening. And then you could actually perhaps start to hear what they're all talking about so much, on and on. And when he was saying that, when I was listening to that this morning, it occurred to me that it is a matter of just holding off, like being a bit patient, waiting a little bit longer. Like, I never smoked a cigarette. It wasn't because, you know, I was some enlightened teenager and a do-gooder, you know, like, I'm not going to smoke because smoking is bad for me. It was just, I never got around to it. I really never got around to it. I just like, oh yeah, I'm going to start smoking, but I never, something always happened. I just never, I kept putting it off. And then, like, people are always asking me, why don't you have children? Why don't you have children? Well, now, you know, I'm 60 years old, so I can't, you know, menopause is coming, you know, I mean, I'm dead, I'm gone in that way. So it's kind of like I never got around to it. It's like if you keep sort of like, it's not like that's not something for a spiritual person to be doing, I'm not going to do that, I'm going to. It's just that you just sort of are patient and you you kind of wait and see what happens. And then it sort of takes care of itself. These things sort of drop away. We don't have access to it anymore.
You want to overcome karma, try getting older.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It works. Yeah. It does work. There's a natural retirement from worldly life. You know, thank you, Sharon.
I talked too much, didn't I?
No, not at all.
I was talking about talking too much, and I talked too much.
No, what it reminds me is, you know, that each of us is on our own particular path. I wish I could claim to never have smoked a cigarette, or, you know, I have children, I've smoked cigarettes, and I inhaled. Yes, I am a recovering materialist. And I look at some people and just they take my breath away. You know, Radhanath Swami or others who just, they seem to have worked all that stuff out, you know, in previous lives. And they just kind of sail through that. It's just not an issue for them. Well, okay, for them, that's the right path. That should not be some kind of an artificial image that we hold for ourselves of, if you're not that, you can't be living the yogic life. You can't be living the spiritual life. And I think that's what Krishna is trying to say to Arjuna here. Know yourself. Know yourself well enough so that the menu that you plan out for your life is a realistic one. That what you do is a mature, thought through balance of just enough of what you have to have so that you can be satisfied without doing yourself damage. You know, if sex and drugs and all of that stuff, you know, is of appeal, and you try going cold turkey and you find yourself contemplating doing it all the time, well, that's not working. Something else has to happen there. Yeah. Yeah.
I think some of what Nick was talking about relates to, we're brought up in a Western culture and we're practicing Eastern philosophy. So we're brought up, a lot of us are first generation spiritual practitioners, but we're raised with a Judeo-Christian dogmic life. So it's, if you don't follow this dogma, you're not going to go to heaven, or you're enlightened. So we're living, we're taking that part of our consciousness and translating it into a spiritual practice. So at times we feel as Westerners, if I don't give up this, then I'm not going to come enlightened and reach a higher state of consciousness. I have to do these things because my brain is telling me to live this way.
How many of you find that? How many of you find that in our discussions about Krishna and the Bhagavad Gita that you find yourself kind of veering over to the religion side? Does that happen for anybody else? Well, if that's true, I'm very happy.
I think of it as more of a philosophical, like a philosophy. But it's true that there's still this feeling of like of punishment for the bad things. Not necessarily from studying Bhagavad Gita, but just in the sense that anything that has to deal with spiritual enlightenment. I think I've sort of been conditioned, like Michael was saying, to believe that anything antagonistic to your spiritual development, you will be punished severely, or something like that.
Yeah. Wow. You know, recently I went to a place of worship. I'll leave it like that. And in this place of worship, there was ritual. And I'm thinking about it, I'm saying, you know, it's lovely. It's not for me. All the, you know, on a daily basis, I couldn't do this. And for some people, that's what they want, and it's what they deserve to have if that's what they want. Ritual for the sake of ritual. And one of the things that Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita is "Yeya tamam prapadyante tamstatayva bhajamyaham." As they approach me, I give myself to them. For some people, religion is what they want. They want the predictability of it. They want someone who's making all the decisions. You know, life is just too scary, or they don't feel qualified to figure out for themselves what to do. And so religion plays a very important part for many people. Others find it utterly abhorrent. You know, the notion of surrendering our own will to some invisible divinity. And so religion is not appropriate for someone like that. And Krishna acknowledges that. He even said, there's a verse later in the Gita where Krishna says, you know, I understand that there are people who relate to me in different ways. And he even mentions four general communities of people. He says there are some people who come to me because they need money. You know, they're hurting, they're in trouble, and they need some shelter. You know, there are people who come to me like that. There are other people who come to me because they're curious. You know, they're interested in philosophy. Right? Then there are others who come to me because they love me. I'm equally disposed to everybody. I kind of have this little extra thing going for the people who come to me because they love me, but it doesn't mean doesn't mean that I'm partial only to them. I'm there for everybody, but someone who comes to me with love, I mean, what can I do?
The Lord loves the one who loves
I knew we'd get a George Harrison quote in here somewhere. You know, so. And you know what? Maybe sometimes it's all good. Maybe sometimes you do want somebody just to make the decisions. Yeah.
I think it's important to make a distinction between religion and faith. You know, religion is a social construct. It's a human construct. Faith is an individual experience.
That's a nice distinction.
You know, you can feel about Krishna the same way you feel about Christ. You know, we're in Santa Gita, Jiva was yoga, is known as the blessed mother.
Lovely. You remind me of Brenda Tippett. Brenda Tippett has a show on National Public Radio that used to be called On Faith, and then she changed it to On Being.
What did she change it to?
On Being is the name of her Sunday morning show. I think it's Sunday morning. Lovely selection of interviews.
Speaking of faith.
Speaking of faith, that was it. Speaking of faith, and now it's On Being. Good point. Thank you. You know what? We got a few minutes left. I got an idea. Grab some popcorn. I like this. This is a new thing. Well, instead of watching a movie, grab some popcorn and then sit next to someone you don't know. Let's do that.
We
do that.
Can you repeat exactly what she said? Me and Carol were trying to understand.
Say again what you
said.
I just said it's